Good evening and welcome to Outsources on KGNU, your weekly LGBTQIA-focused radio show. My name is Ryan Ayala. This week, we have Bruce Valanche, an award-winning writer, comedian, actor, and songwriter, who will be at this year's Jewish Family Services of Boulder's Real Hope Boulder, which is going on to its fifth year. At this event, he will be talking with Ron Bostwick, who has done numerous interviews at Boulder's International Film Festival, as well as interviewed three of the former invited guests for Real Hope Boulder. This event, Real Hope Boulder, will be on October 14th, and you can get your tickets online at jewishfamilieservices.org. Tonight, I am going to discuss with Bruce his decades-long career, as well as some of his opinions on comedy in the current age, his views on the political climate, as well as what's coming up for him in the future. Thank you for tuning in. I have Bruce Valanche, who is a longtime comedian, writer, producer, and a just all-around amazing individual who has been a gay icon, and a pioneer in progressing our community into the mainstream eye. And thank you for being on our show, Bruce.
Wow, well, I'm delighted. Thanks.
Did you like that?
Especially as an eminence grieves.
I hope that was justified. I hope everything I touched on was justice.
That was great.
Okay,
great. It was wonderful. I was flattered. You know, I would date myself, but I'm not my type.
We are interviewing you because you are coming to Boulder for Jewish Family Services, Real Hope Boulder event.
That's right.
You will be here on the 14th of October, which is
a
Saturday. And what will you be doing there? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I will be reading from the Quran. No, that's not true. Say something inflammatory, see what happens. I'll be telling stories about my hysterical career and backstage stuff and things that happened during all of those broadcasts of one thing or another, and probably talking about current events. I mean, it's mostly I'm a storyteller more than anything else, and I've got some stuff to share. So it's unusual. I mean, it's not typical stand-up where somebody, you know, comes and does 40 minutes on what happened when they woke up and in their wife's nightgown and then got locked out of the house and had to go to the show and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Are you excited to be giving I believe that you're giving a talk back, like an after talk for your Get Bruce
film. I'm sure I am. Showing. Here's what I'm excited about. I'm going to be in Colorado, and I'm excited the Supreme Court's going to be hearing the case of the cake baker from Colorado, because I have so much invested in this, because it's, you know, pot is legal in Colorado, and what happens when I smoke pot is I want to eat cake. So I feel like the circle of cake bakers I can patronize is tightening in Colorado because of this, and I would like it to be resolved.
Yes, I hope that you can get as many cakes here as you want, of all styles and layers.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to kind of jump back a couple of years. So Get Bruce was in 1998 by the Weinstein Brothers, and that's an amazing feat to get a whole movie made about you. But where did your career start? And I mean, I don't have a movie about me, so.
I recommend it to anyone. You get to see yourself in various hairstyles and weight levels. So it's fascinating. It's cathartic, is what it is. And you're the only one who hasn't had a movie made about them now. Like everybody is. I mean, it's kind of like I'm expecting it's going to be the next bar mitzvah present. Son, for your bar mitzvah, they're doing a documentary about you. Because there's so little left of it. I mean, every time I turn on the TV, there's another documentary about something, or the making of this, or the dismantling of that. So it's But that's partially because we're become the most narcissistic society on earth. Everywhere you turn, there's somebody with a phone pointing at you, taking a picture, or videoing, or so it's like on Facebook, somebody will write you if there are no pictures, it didn't happen. Hmm. So you can say, oh, I met Obama last week. Really, where's the picture? Because obviously, if you meet Obama, somebody will take a picture of that. It's not you. I mean, it's amazing when you consider when Kennedy was shot in 1963, the only film we have is the Zapruder film. Can you imagine if that happened today? I mean, there would be 75 million versions of it. But that's what happened in 1963, and our culture has changed exponentially because we are now enabled in our narcissism, which we never were before.
How does it feel to be, if I don't know if you've done this before, but visited the documentary and talked about it so many years after? What is that like for you? Is it nostalgic? Is it exciting? And does it like reinvigorate you at all?
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, it's nice. It's hysterical because I always thought it was happening a little prematurely. But you know, when the guy who did it came to me and said, "I think there's a movie in your life," and I said, "Oh, it's a shame. Fellini just died," and I thought he was really the only one who could have done it justice. But this guy said, "No, I'll take a whack at it," and he got all these people to sign off and be filmed, and I was fairly amazed that he pulled it off. So it's it was extraordinary at the time, but what happened is it got released just when Hollywood Squares was taking off and I was on television every night. So it was a double whammy. It got a lot more notice than it would have gotten otherwise. And I was, of course, very grateful for that, and so was my accountant. But when they show it now, my principal fear is that people will look at it and will go, "Wow, that's an old joke," you know, because it is. It's 20 years old, girl. That's how old the movie is.
Right.
So, you know, that's my fear. You know, it's not going to, you know, hold up like on the waterfront. Our modern age has also done is it has killed all the old tropes. It's very difficult to write a movie now because everybody's always looking at their cell phones. And even in movies, plots move by text messages and things that are not fun to photograph. Back in the old days, and everybody knows everything, back in the old days, entire movies would hinge on the fact that he couldn't have known that because he was not near a phone. He wasn't there, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, now everybody knows everything. I mean, Shakespeare would just be, you know, would stab himself with his plume because Romeo could have found out about Juliet beforehand if she just texted him.
True. Yes.
So it makes writing difficult too. So my hat's off to anybody who can work their way around all devices and do stuff that's funny and still, you know, have a sort of reality going on with you know, modern devices and things. Pet peeve.
Is there a movie recently or a writer that you are intrigued by that's been coming up lately and is kind of able to move beyond the screens and the technology and all that and get to a really awesome writing style?
That's a great question, and I feel stupid in having to say no. But that's mostly because I haven't been paying close attention, and I've been so frightfully self-involved that I really haven't had a chance to look at everything. But no, I would have to say no. I'm not inspired by anything in particular. I mean, I'm sure there are brilliant people out there. I just haven't seen them. I mean, I love Eddie Izzard, but he's been around for a while now, and I kind of have to stop saying I love Eddie Izzard because there's got to be somebody newer than Eddie who is really a genius and doing stuff. And Chris Rock is pretty terrific, but again, he's not brand new either. So there aren't a whole lot of people who I find who are doing anything new in the movies, and more of the clever stuff is being done on television anyway, I think, because it's where the millennials watch stuff. As you know, they don't go to the movies for the comedies they go to see are great big special effects kind of comedies. You know, like Girls Trip, where somebody can, you know, can pee on the, on a crowd in the street in New Orleans.
You know, the kind yes, of,
I mean, I was watching the Two Broke Girls the other night, and they did a joke about an orgasm, which, you know, we never could do when I was writing TV sitcoms. I mean, you just couldn't get away with it. Now you can get away with virtually anything. And so in the absence of actual wit, they do stuff. And I'm not picking on Two Broke Girls, but they do. I mean, I would do the joke, too, if I could, if I'd been allowed to do it. But you can be as gross as you want, and that's easy. You can be as gross and as dirty as you want, and that's really easy.
And so we've, you know, you just kind of mentioned how you before, when you were writing for television, you couldn't have talked about orgasms. And we've moved into a time period where, you know, we can talk about gay characters and develop queer identities on television and use sexual language. What is your opinion on that? Has it been, is it being done well? And is it being respected, or is it just being used outlandishly and to gain viewership?
Oh, I think both. I mean, I find that people are being extraordinarily careful in how they characterize other people. I mean, you know, phrases like the N-word indicate to you how scared people are of actually even using the word in a quote context. Or any of the of a group of words like that that you just you can't use. I mean, you have to. It's become they've become up there with the, you know, George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words. So I think that people are being more careful than ever. But on the other hand, I think that within the boundaries of that, without using the actual language, you can show almost anything.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, you know, all the gross-out comedies can be as gross as they want to be, and nobody will stop them. I saw something the other night where the joke was just everybody on a Ferris wheel throwing up.
Ooh.
I forget what it was.
I don't know what that is, but that doesn't sound appealing.
It was funny, but I thought to myself, well, this is where it's at.
Mm.
You know, I mean, stuff that you could only picture in your mind's eye is now acceptable to put out there. And it's that's great, because, I mean, you can sell all your mind's eye stuff. But it's not necessarily the most high-minded, but I suppose you shouldn't worry about it. I guess I'm just, you know, resentful and bitter that I couldn't do it when I wanted to.
Going back to the start of your career and being a very outspoken, proud gay man, what was that like to build your comedic professionalism and your career early
on?
Well,
I didn't build my career on being a proud out gay man. I was not a professional homosexual, and I used to say professional homosexuals should respect the rights of homosexual professionals.
That's good.
I was gay, and I didn't hide it, but I was fortunate in that I worked in an industry and in a world where eccentricity and flamboyance and theatricality were prized. So I was allowed to be all those things. I mean, people who were going to med school or people who were working as CPAs didn't have that luxury. They had to operate, if not in a closet, kind of behind a veil, because the world was not ready for any of that. That's just to accept them in simple things like having a same-sex partner at the company picnic as opposed to a wife, girlfriend, fiance. I mean, little things like that, which I say are little, but in fact they're cosmically huge, because it's all about how you live your life and how you are authentic. And you were not allowed to be authentic. And so that was a horribly inhibiting thing. I was allowed to be authentic because I was in an area where they said, well, as long as he keeps the jokes coming and, you know, makes people happy, we don't care if he brings his goat Sylvia. Sylvia didn't feel the same way, and she left me, but that's another story. Edward Albee will write that one if he ever comes back. But that was not what I was using as a stepping stone, my sexuality, but it was always there. It was never hidden.
You were just you in your comedy. I want to kind of know, where does that part of you come from? Did you always want to be a comedian? Were you always a performer? Or did that develop later in life? What was that?
I was always a performer. I was a child actor. I was never a child star, or we'd be having this conversation in rehab. but I was a child actor. I started making faces in the mirror, you know, and like so many, and I discovered, since I wasn't athletic and I was heavy and I wasn't a conventional kind of kid, I was a reader and I was intellectually curious and I was not a follower, I got picked on. There was no such thing as bullying in those. We didn't know that bullying was a bad thing. First of all, there were no gay kids. You know, kids didn't identify in any sexual terms the way they do now, or even in social terms, as being gay. You were just kind of different, and everybody got picked on. You got picked on. If you were small, you got picked on. If you were black, you got picked on in my school. Everybody got picked on for something, except the kids who were doing the picking, and we called them bullies. But, like, parents never got into it unless it went too far. There was no movement. But that's, you know, one of the offshoots of gay identity coming out of the closet is that we can now take the reins on this and say, you know, these are kids. You can't do this to kids. You have to, you know, you will pay a price if you do this to kids. It's no longer, you know, something like, well, I went through it as a kid and you'll go through it. No, this doesn't work that way anymore. And because we know it's deeper than what we thought.
Right.
So but my original the point I was starting from was, when you're funny, when you can disarm them, as Whoopi says, it gives them a chance to run. It gives you a head start on them. And they if they find you entertaining, they're not going to pick on you quite so much, or they're not, or they're going to do something worse, which is make you their buddy, which is really grim. So I learned that early, and I kind of just kept doing it. So I was always performing, and I got into the writing because my parents were in a panic that I would go to New York, which was right across the George Washington Bridge. And in those days, it was open all the time because Chris Christie was not in charge. And you could go to New York, and they were afraid I would run away and be an actor. So they encouraged me to write. They figured, yeah, you can work newspapers. They'll never go out of style. Oh, we had so few ideas. We didn't know. At one point, they thought I should be a trial lawyer because I could act in the courtroom. They would take me to movies where people... great trial lawyer scenes, Orson Welles in Compulsion, Spencer Tracy in Inherit the Wind, and movies like that. And you know, I was fine. Yeah, I'd like to get up and, you know, but really what I want to, you know, do is do it on Law and Order. I don't want to have to go to law school to do it. Just hand me a script and I'll do it.
And so you ended up going to Ohio State.
Ohio State, journalism and theater combined. A combined program, because they had two strong schools there, and it was in Columbus, Ohio, which was certainly not like New York back then, especially. And I landed there in the middle of the student revolution, and was part of it. But I was covering it. I was the editor of the school paper, so I was supposed to be impartial, because we were covering the conflicts that were going on. But of course, nobody was impartial. I mean. There were Republican kids back then too.
Probably a little bit more. Oh, no, I was going to say a little bit more louder than now, but that's definitely not true.
No, exactly. And it was, when I look back at it, it all was, there was something so civilized about it, because it was all done within the parameters of rational discourse. it wasn't like what you see today, which is, you know, like the Weimar Republic, you know, Germany in the 30s. I mean, it's, you know, crazy, where the leader of the country gets up and says, "Fire that son of a bitch," you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's crazy.
And this movement towards instant, kind of like we were talking about being able to make your own documentary on your film, you're then able to release an article or news information or something as fake news, as we've come to realize, instantly. And it's just out there. When you go back to newspapers, there was a process and there was an editing and there was a time frame in which it was sifted through, and that doesn't seem to exist anymore.
Well, it doesn't on the internet. Certainly, there's no editing. There's no filter. I mean, you know, you go look at Breitbart any day, or go watch the new One America channel. And I mean, I'm sure there are people who call themselves editors, but they're letting stuff go through, which is insane. And generally, most. You know, blogs and things you see, nobody edits anything. They say it's narcissism central. You immediately type out what you feel and hit send. it's great. It's nuts.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go downtown. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where.
Sing to Outsources on KGNU. This week we have Bruce Vilanch, an award-winning writer, actor, comedian, and songwriter, who will be at this year's Real Hope Boulder, put on by Jewish Family Services of Boulder. For more information on the event, you can go to jewishfamilieservices.org.
But that's why you're writing now, all of your own personal stuff, right? To get out and
use that space. I am. But I mean, I'm writing a musical which won't have any of that stuff in it. It's an original book with all the Petula Clark songs from the 60s. And we did it at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut last summer, where it was a big hit. Now I'm retooling it so we can take it to the next level, which will probably be London, because Petula is a goddess in England still.
I don't know who Petula is. Can you enlighten
Petula
me on
Clark
that?
Petula Clark was a big singer in the 60s, and Downtown is probably her most famous.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
And I Know a Place, and Call Me, and I Couldn't Live Without Your Love. I mean, she had a string of big hits, and she had a big performance career, and then they tried to turn her into Julie Andrews. She made a bunch of big flop musicals in Hollywood. And so she retreated to London and became a big British musical stage star. And still, she's 83, and she still tours. She'll be in the U.S. Next month, playing about 5 or 6 dates around the country. Anyway, the songs are very theatrical. I was attracted to them because they're like ABBA, whose songs were very theatrical. Every time I heard an ABBA song, I would think, what show is that from? And I felt the same way about Petula's. And of course, she was about 20 years ahead of ABBA, but which means her audience is even older than ABBA's audience. But we're unafraid. We march relentlessly forward.
Well, I hope you have a great evening, and it was really nice talking to you.
I'd like to thank Bruce Vilanch for coming on to this evening's show. It was a pleasure to interview him and get an insider's view, as well as some good laughs along the way. I look forward to seeing him at Real Hope Boulder on October 14th, an event put on by Jewish Family Services, a behind-the-scenes interview done by Ron Bostwick, who has interviewed many famed individuals at Boulder's International Film Festival, as well as interviewed three of the other Real Hope Boulder special guests. You can find more information at jewishfamilieservices.org, as well as on Outsource's Facebook page. As mentioned numerous times in this episode, Jewish Family Services of Boulder will be putting on Real Hope Boulder, which is starring our guests as the interviewee done by Ron Bostwick, who has interviewed famed individuals at Boulder's International Film Festival, as well as three of the other invited guests for Real Hope Boulder. This fundraiser is put on by Jewish Family Services and supports their organization and all the good work that they've been doing for decades. In the coming weeks, another long-time Denver Boulder metro area nonprofit, Safe House Denver, which is a leader in a domestic violence prevention and services since 1977. They're having their 40th year anniversary, which is amazing. And they offer such services as community advocacy for survivors, a 24-hour crisis and information line, as well as a shelter for those seeking support and safety. In 2016, Safe House Denver sheltered 8,915 nights and 176 women and 100 children. They are an amazing organization, and their yearly event, the Hope Gala, will be on October 21st from 5:30 to 11 at the Sheraton Denver downtown. All proceeds will help survivors of domestic violence by providing safe shelter, advocacy-based counseling, access to resources, and more. You can get tickets online at safehouse-denver.org. October is LGBTQ History Month. As a queer-focused radio show, we try our best every week to integrate our history as a community, both the positive and negative sides, as factors into the development and ability to even have such a radio show air over public media. That's all the time we have for this evening. You can catch our archive shows on kgnu.org/outsources, and you can follow our Facebook page at Outsources on KGNU. Thank you for listening, and have a good evening.